Okay, good morning. So this is Bio 241, and it's Tuesday, January 27th. We're going to finish up the cell chapter, I believe, today. But before we get started, I want to go over some chemistry. So we'll just do a blast from the past real quick on something. All right, so I'm just going to show you some structures. Can you all see the board pretty well, or should I turn some of the lights down? You're good? Okay. So if I show you this, what the heck is this thing? It's a building block for something. It's a nucleotide. What are nucleotides building blocks of? DNA and RNA. And in particular, is this a building block for DNA or RNA? Can't be both. It's for RNA because what we're going to look at is this position on the sugar, and this is a ribosugar because we have an oxygen right here. All right, so you kind of guys are kind of staring at me. Did we go over this in lecture yet? Yeah, chemistry, I think so. All right, so this is what we call a ribonucleotide because it's got a base, it's got the ribosugar and the phosphate right here, ribonucleotide. Okay. All right, and what is this functional group? This is a functional group. This is a sulfhydryl group, right? So that should roll off the tip of your tongue really fast. And what kind of group is that? That's an amino group. And what is that? Carboxyl group. Now, is that an acidic group or a basic group or like neutral? Acidic, right. Yeah, so that makes this compound an acidic compound. And this is a phosphate group. And what is this kind of compound? What's a general class? That's a sugar. And in particular, what kind of sugar? That I would call a monosaccharide. That's a monosaccharide. That's the building block of a polysaccharide. All right, this guy right here. It's a fatty acid. Here's that carboxyl group, and it's just a long chain hydrocarbon with a carboxyl group on it. That's a fatty acid. And in particular, it's a saturated fatty acid because on every carbon, you see that you have two hydrogen atoms on every single carbon. So that's a saturated fatty acid in particular. Okay, what is happening here? What's the name of this reaction? Dehydration synthesis. What is it synthesizing? Here is a triglyceride. So something else I could ask you, what are the building blocks of a triglyceride? You would say glycerol and three fatty acids can be combined via dehydration synthesis to make a triglyceride. Oops. All right, and what is this right here? That's another monosaccharide. And in particular, well, you don't have to know the name, but that would be a fructose. Okay, what is this structure? Okay, I see phospholipids in the circle forming, and there's a hydration sphere around it. So what is this structure that's being made right here of all those phospholipids? That's a micelle, right? That's just an artificial cell made with this artificial membrane, but it's very much like a living membrane. And what are all these compounds? These are steroids, and this top one here even is cholesterol, but cholesterol is a precursor to all these other steroid hormones. You don't have to know the name, but you should at least know that these are steroids, that they are a class of lipids. And I think last time we talked about this one in particular because we find it in the middle of the phospholipid bilayer. Does anybody remember what cholesterol does in the phospholipid bilayer? Yeah, it increases rigidity of the membrane, so it's not quite so fluid. All right, and this guy here. That's a fatty acid because here's that carboxyl group, long chain hydrocarbon, but we see that we don't have two hydrogens on every carbon, so this is an unsaturated fatty acid. And here, can you recognize this guy? It's an acid, and it has an amino group, and it has a variable group right over here. What do you know that has an amino group and an acidic group and another variable group on it? Amino acid. Yeah, what's that a building block of? Proteins, for instance. And this guy, phospholipid, right? So here is the phosphate, here's the glycerol, here are two fatty acids. So this is the hydrophobic region, this is the hydrophilic region of the molecule. So phospholipid. And in particular, this is a diagram of lecithin. All right, these compounds. Tell me something about these guys. What's the general class name? Prostaglandins. And are they proteins, or are they sugars, or are they lipids, or nucleic acids? Okay, these are lipids. These are lipids because basically what they are is just a long chain hydrocarbon with this acid group right here. So they're just fatty acids basically that have been bent back on each other and a couple modifications to it. Okay. Okay, so they're a lipid. And this thing right here. Okay, it's the alpha helix. So what kind of structure is this in a protein? What is it? It's a secondary structure. Yeah, it contributes to secondary structure of a protein. What's the other kind of configuration that is secondary structure? That beta pleated sheet. I don't have a picture of that, but instead of nice curly ends, it's what? Sharp zigzagged ends in that protein. So what's the building block of this secondary structure? Primary structure, just a sequence of amino acids that make up this protein. All right. And this right here. Okay, that's a deoxyribonucleotide, right? It's a nucleotide, a building block, and a lot of people said DNA. That's great because notice that it's missing the oxygen right here. So that's a deoxyribonucleotide. And that's a hydroxyl group. And this molecule is glycerol, three carbons and an OH, a hydroxyl group on each one of those carbons. And that is phospholipid once again. And what's that? Okay, that's close. Somebody said carboxyl, not quite, unless I didn't quite hear you quite right. That's a carbonyl group, carbonyl. Okay, carbonyl group. All right, so I think this is pretty much where we started. All right, so let's go through it pretty fast. All right, so as soon as you see the structure, let me know what it is, the chemical structure. But you probably don't want to blink, okay? What was that? Sulfhydryl group, right? Did you see it before it went away, hopefully? What about that? Amino group. What about that? Okay, I left it on too long that time. My finger was slow. Carboxyl group. What's that? Phosphate group. I would say monosaccharide, building block of polysaccharide. What kind of fatty acid? Saturated fatty acid. What is that? Triglyceride formation via dehydration synthesis reaction. What was that? That was another monosaccharide. That was another monosaccharide. Should I go back? Okay. Monosaccharide, this is a six-carbon sugar, and you can see what? A carbon with an H2O on every carbon right here. Okay, so that's a monosaccharide. What about this right here? Micelle? Steroids? Unsaturated fatty acid? Amino acid? Maybe you can see the carboxyl group and the amino group and that variable side chain on that alpha carbon. Phospholipid. Prostaglandin. Alpha helix. What's the building block of an alpha helix? Primary structure of a protein. Ooh, that was pretty fast. Let's go back. Okay, it's a nucleotide. Which kind? It's a deoxyribonucleotide. This is the kind of nucleotide that makes DNA, not RNA. All right, this might be one of the last ones. What was that? That's a hydroxyl group. And that molecule is glycerol, right? That's glycerol. And what do we got here? That was another phospholipid. Carbonyl group. And that was the ribonucleotide that makes RNA. It's a building block for RNA. And sulfhydryl group. All right, so on my website is a little video that plays this over and over again. I would guess if you watch that video three times, you'll memorize all those functional groups and structures, right, pretty easily. But if you want to go over that again, let me know sometime. maybe at the beginning of class next time. You don't have a test next week, but my guess is maybe you have a test 2 weeks from today, right? 2 weeks from today. It's either today or Thursday. I can't quite remember. So it's coming up. Okay, so those are some pictures that could be on the test. All right, so let's go back to our PowerPoints. We were talking about surface specializations. Actually, I kind of consider these things as organelles on a cell because they give a certain kind of function to the cell. Cilia and flagella are projections or processes. What's a process in terms of anatomy? What's a process on something? A process on a bone is what? Is it a depression? Okay, process. A divot, sometimes we call a fossa or a fovea, okay, but that's not really a process. A process is what? Something poking off the surface of a bone, right? It's a raised area. And so anytime we use that word process, we could talk about projections of something sticking off the surface of the cell, just like a part of a bone sticking off the surface of the bone. So cilia and flagella and microvilli are miniature processes sticking off the surface of the cell. Cilia and flagella have special kinds of microfilaments and microtubules in them that allow them to wiggle back and forth. Okay? So these help move things around over the surface of the cell in the case of the cilia, or in the case of the flagella, it actually propels the cell through an aqueous environment. It can swim around. And there's only one kind of cell in the human body that has a flagellum, and that's a sperm, right? Those guys can swim around all over the place. So motility just means what? It can make things go in motion, all right? Microvilli, on the other hand, aren't important for motility, but they increase the surface area for absorption across the cell membrane. So they're important for membrane transport. So if we think of the cilia as having a certain length, the flagella or a flagella might be 20 times as long as a cilia, right? So it's really, really long. Microvilli, on the other hand, might only be maybe 20% the size of a cilium. So they're very, very small. They're very short. If you ever tried to look at microvilli with a light microscope in anatomy lab, it was probably difficult to see them. Maybe you could get an impression that they were there, but you really couldn't see a very good structure. It was pretty much just a blur. Cilia, on the other hand, you can see very nicely, even with a light microscope. Okay? And they have these microtubule systems. So here is an example of a cilium. And it has microtubules on the inside, and these microtubules can slide past each other. So, for instance, if I put these two markers together side by side, they have a certain length. And how could I make the length of these two markers longer? I could just slide the two markers, right, telescope them past each other like that. So now it's longer. And actually, when it moves like this, it's going to bend as well, because one side is really long and the other side is short, so when one side of a cilia gets longer, guess what happens? It bends, right? And then when they slide back together again, they get to have the same kind of shape. So that's how a cilium works for motility, because it has those microtubules on the inside. Microvilli, on the other hand, are small extensions of the cell surface which increase surface area. And in this class, when I say surface area, I want you to think of an everyday word in terms of what surface area means in terms of function. All right, so how do we measure the surface area of something? How do we know what the surface area is? Okay, like for instance, what's the surface area of the sign-in sheet right here? Yeah, it's like 8.5 by 11 or something like that. And so then you just multiply those two numbers together to calculate the square inches of that piece of paper. All right, so I'm going to pass this around for you guys to sign in for today. So that's the surface area of something. And over here, we have something else. What is this thing right here? That's a doorway, right? That's a doorway. And what's the surface area of this doorway right here? We don't know, but we got a ruler. So we can measure it, and look, oh, it's exactly, this is a meter stick, so it's exactly 1 meter wide. And how tall is it? Okay, so here is 1 meter, Here is 2 meters, right here. Oh, look, it's exactly 2 meters tall. So that's really easy for us to calculate what the surface area of this door. What's the surface area of this door? It is 1 meter times 2 meters. It's 2 square meters. That's the surface area of that door right there. All right, so when I say surface area, I want you to think of that structure right there. What is that? That's a doorway. So when I say surface area, I actually want you to think doorway. And what does that mean? This doorway allows exchange, for instance, of people from inside the room to the outside or from the outside to the inside of the room. That's what that doorway is. And for instance, instead of this 2 square meter doorway, maybe we have a garage door, which is taller and it's a lot wider, right? So the surface area increases when you have a garage door. How many people can get through that small one, just that pedestrian door right there at one time? 2, maybe 3, okay? But if it's a garage door, how many people can get through at one time? Oh yeah, 20, 30 people, something like that, right? So as the surface area increases, what happens to exchange through the doorway? Does it increase or go down or stay the same? It increases, right? So when you increase the surface area of something, you increase the doorway for exchange. That's the importance of surface area and how you would measure it. So if you have microvilli on the apical surface of some kind of membrane, so microvilli are like this, why do we say that increases the surface area? Because if we were to take these two ends and flatten it out, what would be the length of this line? Right? It would be 3 or 4 times longer. But not just in this dimension, but also in the dimension coming out of the board. So the surface area increases because of these microvilli. So this takes a big surface area, folds it up so it doesn't take so much space inside your body. But it still allows for that enhanced exchange to take place. All right, so when I say surface area, what should you think?
Doorway.
Yeah, I always just think of a doorway. Okay. All right, so what's the next topic? All right, let's get to some organelles. Okay, cytoplasm is everything that's inside the plasma membrane or the cell membrane. It's all the living material inside the cell. And cytoplasm is made up of two kinds of compartments that you should think of. The fluid part is what we call cytosol, but cytoplasm is also made up of organelles. So organelles are the structures inside the cell, but there is also the cytosol, the fluid part inside the cell. It's both of these. So cytoplasm is equal to cytosol plus organelles, and you could just write a little algebraic equation for yourself if you wanted to. Okay, the cytoskeleton is due to the arrangement of microtubules and microfilaments inside the cell. It forms a lattice, and organelles are attached to that microtubule system. There are proteins within the membrane that attach to the microtubule system, and these microtubules can move the organelles around inside the cell, can move vesicles around inside the cell, and it can also pull or push on the cell membrane, so that gives the cell its particular shape. So what's your favorite shape of a cell? What's your favorite one? Yeah, what kind of shape of cell is your favorite? Didn't you look at any in anatomy? I'm sure you did. What are some? Cuboidal. Okay, yeah, cuboidal is pretty cute kind of cell. Just this little cube. What else? Squamous, which is flat, and columnar. Right, and cells have different shapes because these microtubules can push and pull on the membrane via those integral proteins, and it gives a cell a particular shape. And not only that, some cells are shapeshifters. Did we look at a macrophage in one of the previous slides? We talked about phagocytosis, how a cell can actually surround a particle, and that's because these microtubules are pushing and pulling on the cell membrane, causing it to form around a particular material. Okay. Another way that you might want to think about these microtubules is that a vesicle can attach itself to a microtubule, and the microtubule then can move it around inside the cell. So you could think of a microtubule system as being a railroad track, but not a very common one. How many rails does a usual kind of train have? It has two, right? Unless it's an electric one, then there might be a third one that carries electricity. All right, but these are kind of nifty because there's only one rail to it. What do we call a train that operates just on one rail? Disneyland has one. That's a monorail. So think of these microtubules as being like a monorail system inside the cell where things can hop a ride and go from one place inside the cell to another. Okay, so that's the microtubule system. So all of these guys here, you have to know. So here is the plasma membrane. Did we talk about that already? Yeah, I think we talked about the plasma membrane. How would you best describe the internal structure of the plasma membrane in its simplest case, the simplest case? Phospholipid bilayer. And a more sophisticated appreciation of the plasma membrane could be described as the fluid mosaic model, right? Because dissolved into the phospholipid bilayer are going to be a bunch of other functional proteins or other kinds of molecules that stabilize the plasma membrane. Okay, so here is the inside of the cell and some organelles that we see. Mitochondria, right over here. We see vesicles, which are these spherical shaped structures, and we see this membrane system right here we call endoplasmic reticulum. Here's another kind of endoplasmic reticulum. This one has a rough surface, so we call this rough ER. This is smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And we see some microtubules, centrioles over here. The job of the centrioles is to organize and adjust the function of the microtubules. All right, so these centrioles are actually made up of microtubules, and their job is to coordinate the activity of the rest of the microtubules that make up the cytoskeleton inside the cell. These mitochondria right here, we're going to spend about a month looking at mitochondria in terms of their biochemistry, because what do they do for the cell? They make ATP, right? They make energy to power our cells to keep us alive. So we're going to look at all those chemical reactions and parts of the mitochondria. Okay, so for mitochondria, you should just say it makes ATP. It requires oxygen. It's going to produce CO2. We breathe oxygen in our bodies. The mitochondria can make ATP. Mitochondria release CO2, and then we excrete CO2 when we exhale, for instance. Okay, so mitochondria function is to synthesize ATP. Now, how important is ATP in your bodies? Very important. Now, to give you a feel for how important that is, right, mitochondria cannot make ATP when there is no oxygen available, right? Or actually, we'll find out just a very little amount, but not enough to keep most cells alive. Mitochondria need oxygen. And your brain is a very metabolic organ. It needs functional mitochondria all the time, just cranking out ATP. So I have a question for you. How long will your brain function if we cut off oxygen to your brain? Okay. As a matter of fact, it's only about 3 seconds. All right. If we cut off oxygen supply, if we stop blood flow to somebody's brain, 3 seconds, they will become unconscious. All right. So that means that your brain has run out of ATP already at that point in time. And the next question is, when will the brain actually die? How long does it take the brain to die if you cut off oxygen? You lose consciousness in 3 seconds. So when does the brain actually die? When is it that it can never be revived again? Because death is an irreversible process. And you're saying 3 minutes. And you know what? You're right. After 3 minutes, when blood is cut off to the brain, that brain is dead. How does that strike you? Is it a long time or a short time? Really short period of time, right? So when somebody's heart stops beating, they lose consciousness in 3 seconds, and somebody that knows CPR basically has just a couple minutes, right, to start doing chest compressions to get that circulation going to preserve their brain. And then they got to get to an ER, and hopefully somebody can start their heart up again normally. Or maybe there's an automatic electronic defibrillator someplace close. I've heard that there are 2 on campus. I don't know their location. And of course you can, which is too bad because you only have 3 minutes to find these things. And I'm in the age group where I should know. You guys aren't in that age group yet, but I should find out where they are. The next closest one probably is Disneyland again. They have a number over there of them. Oh, I know a good place, the fire station on Holder. I'm sure they have a bunch of automatic electronic defibrillators. And those guys probably could get here in 3 minutes if you call them. Okay. So don't forget, for me, call them. Yeah. Yeah. That's could be one of the reasons, and that could be due to maybe a lack of blood pressure at some particular time. And your blood pressure does drop fairly precipitously when you change body position. For instance, if you're lying down and stand up very quick, or if you're sitting down for a two-hour lecture and then you stand up right away, you'll lose blood pressure, and if you don't compensate for that, you will pass out. We call that syncope. Okay, that's usually not too life-threatening unless you hit your head on the table and then the chair and then the floor, bonk, 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 right? That's not so good. Okay, so that's the importance of that organ. And as a matter of fact, maybe let me just give you another reference how important ATP is. And that is, let's consider what a textbook-sized person is going to be. If we look in a textbook, and women are a little bit smaller than men, but a textbook, does anybody have a feel for, in terms of kilograms, what an average man should weigh, according to a textbook? 70 kilograms is the typical kind of thing, and most people I know are way over 70 kilograms, so that was probably published like 30 or 40 years ago, right? But nonetheless, let's just say 70 kilograms. So in terms of weight, how much ATP does your body require every day to stay alive? Maybe as a percentage of your body weight. The amount of ATP that you need is 40 kilograms. So these mitochondria here, as soon as an ATP is burned up, they synthesize another one. As a matter of fact, 40 kilograms, over half your body weight every day just to stay alive. So that's a real important job, and they never get a break. All right. Now, another interesting thing about this mitochondria right here is that they have their own DNA, and they have their own cytoplasm. Okay, and that's a definition for something. What is something that's surrounded by a membrane that has cytoplasm and genetic material? What do we call that? We call that a cell, right? So these mitochondria are actually cells within cells, and if you look at them closely after you take a microbiology class, they actually look like a bacteria. They function just like bacteria, but they don't cause an infection. They actually produce something very helpful for us, and we call that what? ATP. And so now everybody agrees, this is a theory. So what's a theory? It's a tested hypothesis that's backed up with a lot of experimental evidence. So we call this the endosymbiont theory of mitochondria. So what is a symbiosis? What's a symbiosis? It's when there has to be two organisms, and what do these two organisms do with each other all the time? They work together so that they both can live and function. Okay? So what we have right here is an endosymbiont. This is a very ancient kind of bacteria that infected a fairly advanced cell, like a human cell that had a nucleus, and they learn to live together, and they both get something from the relationship. So human cells, what do human cells get from mitochondria? They get ATP. Is that a good thing to get? Oh, yeah, that's a very excellent thing. That's excellent. So this cell is happy because it's getting ATP. Now, what does the mitochondria get? It's got to get something in order for it to be a symbiosis. It gets oxygen, yeah, because we're breathing, and the mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP. Plus, another thing that it gets is if the mitochondria is inside the cell, it's protected from being infected by other kinds of viruses or being eaten by bacteria. So the predation pressure goes way down. It can live a nice, very happy life inside human cells. So that's something else that it gets from being inside of a cell. All right, so this mitochondria, and because it has its own DNA, it controls its own replication. It divides whenever it wants to in order to meet the demands of ATP of this particular cell. Okay. All right, these vesicles. Let's talk about vesicles for a little bit. There's a couple kinds of vesicles. I see two on this particular slide. And a lysosome in particular is filled with digestive enzymes that we call lysozyme. And lysozyme can break proteins down into what? What can a digestive system break a protein down into? Amino acids. Or it can break down complex sugars or polysaccharides into monosaccharides, right? It would just chop those molecules up. So a lysosome is an intracellular digestive system that breaks big biological molecules down into their building blocks. And this secretory vesicle right here might contain some lysozyme, but it might also contain other kinds of products that are going to be secreted from the cell. So we call this a secretory vesicle. Here is maybe an example of a vesicle that's bumped into the cell membrane, and you see it fused to the cell membrane, and when it does that, there's an opening that opens up from the inside of the vesicle to the extracellular space, so whatever is in this vesicle gets secreted outside the cell. So we would call that a secretory vesicle. Another kind of vesicle, which we don't really have on this slide right here, is going to look a lot like this lysosome, but we call that a peroxisome. And a peroxisome contains other kinds of enzymes called peroxidase, and peroxidase detoxifies toxic compounds that build up by the normal metabolism of the cell. So again, a lysosome is important for, if you're just going to think of one word, you would say digestion. The one-word description of a peroxisome would be detoxification, right? Okay, and the secretory vesicle right here is going to be important for secretion of something outside the cell. All right, and one particular product that this a cell might secrete would be mucus. Does anybody know what kind of cell secretes mucus from anatomy? That's a goblet cell. It's just a unicellular gland. And mucus is part protein and part sugar. It's a mucopolysaccharide. And that gets put into this vesicle, and the goblet cell moves this vesicle to the plasma membrane. How does it get over to the plasma membrane? It hops a ride on that monorail system, goes to the plasma membrane, and then the interior contents of that vesicle are released to the outside world. Okay. Another kind of organelle that we have are these little dots right here. I call them blue dots, but I've been told they're not really blue. What color are they? Huh? I can't quite hear anybody. Pink. Okay, they're pink, not blue. Okay, well, I don't know if I told you guys, but pink and blue look like exactly the same color to me. Did I tell you that? That I'm colorblind? All right, so that's something actually I probably should have told you the first day, but it's too late to drop the class. No, it's not. You could still drop the class over the weekend. So sometimes during lecture, right, I might ask you what color is something and just tell me because I just don't see it up there. So these little pink dots right here are ribosomes. And ribosomes are responsible for one step in protein synthesis. We're going to look at that today, the steps involved in protein synthesis. So ribosome is the workbench where proteins are built. So you would say the function of a ribosome is for protein synthesis. You have to have a ribosome. All right, so here we have endoplasmic reticulum. It's a membrane system. And what do you see on this endoplasmic reticulum? It's loaded with ribosomes. So that means that this ER can actually synthesize proteins because it has ribosomes on it. So that's the function of rough ER. This endoplasmic reticulum right here does not have ribosomes, so can it make a protein? No. It has other functions inside the cell. It functions as a factory for making lipids, like phospholipids or converting steroids around. All right, so that's its job. Lipid synthesis for smooth ER, protein synthesis for rough ER. And the smooth endoplasmic reticulum in some cells also acts as a reservoir for calcium ions. And we'll talk about that. Where do you know in your body where calcium is an important ion to have? In bones. Yep, in bones. That's very, very important. And in this class, you'll see that it's even more important for other aspects of your body to function as well. And some of those cells will find that calcium in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Yeah. Where else are they stored? Okay, your bones are a good storage facility for calcium. All right, but that's not really in a soluble form. It's more like a crystal. But where it's stored as an ion in solution is inside the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. So if those cells need a big rush of calcium for some reason, it can be released from the smooth endoplasmic reticulum and flow through the cell. All right, so what else are we looking at here? That's smooth. All right. Yeah. You know, in some cells, there's a little bit of a mechanical coupling between certain things inside the cell, but other ways that calcium is released is controlled by a voltage, by some electricity. So that doesn't require mechanical coupling. Yeah, so it can go either way with smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Okay. All right. What else on this particular slide? You see cytosol. Oh, you see ribosomes in two different locations. You see ribosomes in the cytosol. You see ribosomes on endoplasmic reticulum. That means that when a ribosome synthesizes a protein, it has two different fates. It can end up in two different areas. If it's a free ribosome, that protein is going to end up in the cytosol, floating around inside the cell, doing its job. But if it's made by endoplasmic reticulum, it is released to the inside of the endoplasmic reticulum, and it can't float around inside the cell. And what happens to it is that then that protein moves from endoplasmic reticulum into something that we call a Golgi apparatus. All right, so here is a Golgi apparatus. And there that protein is modified. So a protein in the Golgi apparatus might be modified, might be conjugated with a polysaccharide, becoming a mucopolysaccharide, like, for instance, mucus. And then that product will pinch off into a vesicle. So I would say maybe this looks like a nice secretory vesicle. And that protein finds its way outside the cell. So this is what we call the secretory pathway. Proteins that are made by rough endoplasmic reticulum are destined to move outside the cell. Proteins that are made by free ribosomes stay inside the cell. Two different fates, depending on where they are manufactured. All right, so I think I talked about all this kind of stuff. Oh, some fine structure of a mitochondria. Notice that there is an outer membrane and an inner membrane. And these inner membrane folds are what we call Christi. And there's even some cytosol inside the inner membrane. We call that the matrix of the mitochondria. And we'll be using that terminology when we get to some biochemistry on how this mitochondria works. Okay, here's a huge illustration of a mitochondria, not mitochondria, of ribosome. Okay, it kind of looks like a sphere. And maybe you can tell that this ribosome is made up of two different parts. So here's maybe one color over here. It looks like a dark gray. Here's a light gray over here. Ribosomes have two parts to it. And there's even a tunnel going through it. Right? And these ribosomes will assemble during protein synthesis. All right, so here is smooth ER, rough ER. We talked about its functions. Here is a nice diagram that we didn't see on the large picture of the cell that illustrates the secretory pathway. All right, so here is rough ER responsible for protein synthesis. These proteins then move to like a terminal cisternae of the rough ER, and this little membrane pinches off of the rough ER, becomes a vesicle, and then it's transported to the Golgi apparatus right here on that little monorail system. These proteins now are on the inside of the Golgi apparatus where they're modified. And after they're modified, they're pinched off by these little terminal cisternae right here. They're packaged into these vesicles. So the job of the Golgi apparatus, two keywords, modification and packaging, modification and packaging. So Golgi apparatus is going to modify a protein, maybe convert it into a lipoprotein or a sugar protein. Or maybe we'll just chop a protein into a couple pieces, changing its shape. And then it gets packaged into a vesicle for secretion. So this right here is an example of exocytosis. It requires ATP to move these molecules around. And whenever a membrane transport process requires ATP, we call it active transport. Active means it requires ATP. Okay, so here is the nucleus. Can you picture where it was inside the cell? It was in the very middle interior part of the cell. And the nucleus surrounds So the nuclear membrane right here surrounds the DNA that we have inside the nucleus. So it protects that DNA because the function of DNA is twofold. It contains the blueprints on how to build a cell, but it also contains the information on how that cell should function. So both things, how the cell functions, but also how to make that cell, and as a matter of fact, all the cells of your body and how they're put together to make your body. So that information is very precious, because what would happen to the cell if that information in DNA got damaged? What would happen to the function of that cell? It would change, and usually not for the better. Usually that cell would die. So it's very important to keep that information nice and safe. And so that's the job of the nuclear membrane right here. It protects the DNA. So I think of the nucleus of a cell right here as being very similar to the reserve section of the library. What do you got in that reserve section of the library? Anybody ever use the reserve section? You all bought your textbooks already? That's great. Because they're copies of the textbook in the reserve section of the library. Yeah, you can check the reserve book out of the reserve section, but you can't take it out of the library, right? So the reserve section has books that are very valuable, that are difficult to replace, right? You can take it and make a photocopy of it, right? But then you got to take the reserve book back to where it belongs so it doesn't get damaged, right? So that's really pretty much what the nucleus does too. It protects all of that valuable information, right? There is one process that can make a photocopy of that information so it can leave the nucleus and go into the cytoplasm, right? And if it gets damaged, that's not such a big deal. That won't kill the cell, because why? You still have the original copy in the nucleus. If you need that information again, you can go get another photocopy of it, right? Just like in the reserve section. We put those books there so that everybody has access to it and you can make a photocopy of it. All right, and then that photocopy can move through the nuclear envelope or even through these nuclear pores right here. The most active part of the nucleus is what we call the nucleolus. That's where most of that photocopying machinery is working, with making a copy of the information in DNA. So this is the most active part of the nucleus, the nucleolus. Okay, and even on the nuclear envelope, I see some ribosomes here too for protein synthesis. All right, proteins and RNA must be actively transported through the nuclear envelope. Some small molecules can actually diffuse through these nuclear pores right here. Okay, but DNA, where does DNA always spend its time? Inside the nucleus, never leaves the nucleus. All right. Only during certain kinds of times when the cell is dividing, when the nucleus disappears, can the DNA leave the nucleus because the nucleus is gone. All right, so you saw all those different structures inside of a cell, and I know I used to wonder, why does a cell have all these different organelles right there? Why does a cell have all those different organelles? It seems awfully complicated with all that stuff in there, moving around here and there. Why not just have the machinery that does all this stuff just kind of loose floating around inside a cell? Maybe like a bacteria. Bacteria does that. But why do more advanced cells like human cells have all these organelles?
They all have different functions.
Because they all have different functions. This is true. Like some make ATP, some make proteins, some make lipids, right? And a model I use in my mind, for instance, is this building right here. Think of this building as a cell. And let's pretend that this building only had one big room in it instead of all the rooms that it has. And if it only had one room, what would be happening during, noon on Tuesday? There would be a physiology lecture. There'd be a couple of physics lectures. There'd be people doing chemistry experiments and people doing math and getting a math lecture. And so if in this building we had 30 or 40 lectures going on at the same time, that seems like, that could be really efficient because I could graduate in just one semester. All I have to do is show up and I could learn physics and math and chemistry and biology and physiology and anatomy all at the same time. But would it work? No. All of those disciplines, all that going on would interfere with each other, right? So what do we do to a building so that there can be numerous different activities going on all at the same time without interference? Yeah, we put rooms in a building, right? The same thing for a cell. So all these organelles have very specific functions, and there's organelles so that that function can take place without interfering with other important living functions of the cell. So that's the job of those organelles. So it prevents interference from taking place. And they're usually carried out behind these different membranes. Now, there are some organelles that don't have membranes, like these centrioles right here and the microtubules. Ones that have membranes around them, we call membrane-bound. The ones that don't have membranes, we just say they're not membrane-bound. That's what where that term came from. It doesn't mean that the membrane binds them up somehow or another. It just means surrounds or defines what that organelle is. So, for instance, this Golgi apparatus right here, is that a membrane-bound organelle? Yeah, there's the membrane right there. All right, now what can you tell me about the nature of the membrane of this Golgi apparatus compared to the membrane of this nuclear envelope and the plasma membrane and even this membrane on the mitochondria? What's the simplest way that you could describe what its internal structure looks like? What's it made out of? What's a building block of all those membranes? That's going to be phospholipids, and when you put phospholipids together, what do you get? You get a phospholipid bilayer, right? So that's the best way to describe just a very simple membrane, and all these membranes pretty much are identical, all right? So that is why membranes of a vesicle, like a secretory vesicle right here, when it bumps into the plasma membrane, it can just fuse together, because what's the nature of those two membranes? They're identical to each other, right? So they mix and match up just perfectly. And probably you've seen something like that before. Did you ever see, I wouldn't accuse any of you of doing this, but maybe get a little soap bottle with some liquid soap in there and a hoop, and you stick the hoop in the soap bottle and pull it out and wave it in the air, what do you get? You get those little bubbles, right, that have the little film of soap over it. So think of that as being an organelle, a membrane-bound organelle or a cell or something. And sometimes when those two bubbles bump into each other as they're floating around, they pop. That's not so interesting. But every once in a while, when they touch each other, what happens to them? They form a huge, big balloon, right, that floats around. So the same process takes place with these membrane-bound organelles. They can fuse together. They can pinch apart, because the film or that membrane is what identical from one organelle to another. There's nothing special that's going on there, just like those soap bubbles. Okay. All right, gene expression. This is probably a really important slide, not in your book, but what do we have right here? This is what we call the central dogma of biology, or information flow, how information flows between different molecules inside your cells. And dogma just means, it really has a religious connotation to it. It's just something that you're told and something that you should believe in. Okay, that's what a dogma is. Now, where does that have a place in science? What's the purpose of science, really? Is to not just believe everything you're told, but you should actually back it up with scientific evidence, right, and challenge it. Always challenge authority in science. You're always testing and probing to see if something's true. But so I use this term dogma right here because this is a good place for you to start to learn how information flows via various kinds of chemicals in your body. But as you learn more and more biology, you might have to modify this scheme a little bit, right? So this is not a theory, this is dogma that you should challenge, but this is a good place to start to learn something. Okay, so DNA, what does that stand for? Deoxyribonucleic acid, right? And did we look at the base pairing rules for DNA yet in here? I can't remember, right? There's GC and AT, and the sugar is a deoxyribose. I showed you a deoxyribonucleotide. That's the building block of this DNA. And where do we find DNA all the time in a cell that's not dividing? Is it running around in the cytoplasm someplace? No, never, because it could be corrupted. And if it is, then that's the death of the cell. So it's protected behind the nuclear envelope. It's inside the nucleus. So the information in DNA can be copied into RNA. Okay? And so that happens inside the nucleus. And then this information can leave the nucleus and go into the cytoplasm, like going through the nuclear envelope, or maybe some kinds of RNA can go through those nuclear pores, into the cytoplasm. And the RNA is then used to make a protein. All right? So this is a little scheme that shows protein synthesis, how a cell can make protein, and you can see it's a two-step process. What's the first step? So the step is symbolized by this arrow right here. That's a step, and here's a second step. All right, so protein synthesis requires two steps in order for it to take place. The first step takes place where? Where's the location of the first step? In the nucleus, because DNA can never leave the nucleus. All right, so what is the building block of DNA? It's a nucleotide. What's the building block of RNA? It's a nucleotide as well, right? So the language that makes up DNA and RNA are the same. They're almost the exact same molecule, just what? Small difference, just that one oxygen atom on the ribose, and then there's a base that could be different, but those are really minor modifications between DNA and RNA, all right? So we call that transcription. So what the heck does transcription really mean, right? In terms of biology right here, transcription is the conversion of information from DNA into RNA. Well, what does transcription mean in everyday English words? You do this all the time, I'm sure. When you copy something, for instance, yeah, when you make an exact duplicate copy of something, and did you ever have to ask admission and records for a transcript? What's a transcript? It's just a photocopy of all your grades and classes that you took by semester. And then you could give that to another college, or if you're applying for a job or something, they might want to see transcripts. It's a photocopy. All right. They don't ever give you your official record admission, because if admissions and records gave you the official copy, then they wouldn't have a copy of it, right? So they make a transcript, which is a duplicate. So 2,000 years ago, if you needed a transcript from admission and records, what would they have to do? Well, they'd have to buy a candle and a feather and an inkwell and do what? Make an exact copy just out by hand, right? But today, what do we use? Photocopy machine, right? A photocopy machine makes a transcript, and we call this transcription because the language of DNA is exactly the language of RNA, which is some very minor modifications. It's the same language, so we call that transcription. All right, so don't forget, DNA never leaves the nucleus. It makes a copy, RNA, and that can go into the cytoplasm. And if the RNA gets damaged, is that such a big deal? No, because the DNA is still there that has that information in case the cell needs to get it again. All right, so RNA moves into the cytoplasm, and then the information in RNA is used to make a protein. And this second step we call translation. We don't call that transcription, that's what we call translation. So what the heck does translation mean in everyday English language? When would you need to translate something? When you go from one language to another language, right? Like from English to Farsi, right? Or Greek to Hindi, or something like that. That's when you need a translator who knows both languages that can tell you what the meaning is, right? All right, so this is translation because RNA, what kind of language is RNA in? What's the basic building block of RNA? That's nucleotide. What's the language of protein? What's the building block of protein? Amino acid. So it's going from nucleotide language to amino acid language. Can you just make a photocopy, a transcript? No, you need a translation program to do that. So we call that translation. So other things you should know about this is, a good question would be, where does transcription take place? In the nucleus. Where does translation take place? In the cytoplasm, right? Or cytosol, exactly right. Okay. And this is just a one-way street. It doesn't go backwards, right? So information in proteins can't be used to make RNA. And information in RNA can't be used to make DNA. It's really a one-way street. And personally, I find that very reassuring. That's really nice. Because, for instance, tonight when I go home and have a chicken dinner, I don't have to worry about waking up in the morning with a beak and feathers. That information and all those proteins, right, can't change my DNA. It doesn't go backwards like that, right? It only goes from DNA to RNA to proteins. Maybe you never had any nightmares like that. That's good. Okay. So that's what we call the central dogma of biology. So don't forget, transcription, DNA to RNA, their physical structures, but more importantly, think of it as information. Going from DNA to RNA, happens in the nucleus, never cytoplasm. Oh, here is a little definition. A gene on DNA is a sequence of nucleotides, right? Because DNA is just a long string of nucleotides put together. That's a set of instructions on how to make a specific protein. And we used to think that if an organism had five proteins, if an organism could make five proteins, it needed five genes. And for instance, the human needs tens of thousands of proteins, say 20,000 proteins. The human genome, or the number of genes in a human's body, would be 20,000, right? If there's 20,000 proteins, you needed 20,000 genes. We know now that that's not quite true. We'll talk about that later, right? But a gene, just think of a gene as instructions to make a protein. Okay, translation, of course, happens in the cytoplasm. It converts RNA into a protein. And different kinds of RNA, let's see, do I have different kinds? Did we learn different kinds of RNA? Yeah, we learned ribosomal RNA, transfer RNA, and messenger RNA. And it's that messenger RNA, the linear sequence of nucleotides and messenger RNA determines or defines the linear sequence of amino acids, which make up a protein. Now, what did we call the linear sequence of amino acids of a protein? What's the linear sequence of amino acids in a protein? What do we call that? That's primary structure. And that's a building block for the secondary structure, which is the building block for tertiary structure, and then even onto quaternary structure if it has different multiple components in there. So what I'm saying here is that the primary structure of this messenger RNA right here, just the sequence of nucleotides in RNA, determines the primary structure of a protein. We'll see how that goes in this chapter. All right, so the primary structure of the RNA, in particular the messenger RNA, determines how amino acids are put together to make a protein, which determine the shape of the protein. And if the shape of that protein is defined, what are we really defining? Because what goes hand in hand with structure?
Function,
that's right. So the linear sequence of nucleotides in this messenger RNA determine what the function of that protein is going to be. Okay. All right, so those are some kind of nice, easy slides, but important to get a feel for. All right, so genes are just lengths of DNA that code for the synthesis of RNA. And in particular, one is messenger RNA, and this carries information for how to make that protein. It determines the primary structure of that protein, and it's transported out of the nucleus where it binds to ribosomes where proteins are made. So don't forget, a ribosome is just a workbench where amino acids are put together to make a protein. Okay, we talked about that already. The most active part of the nucleus where transcription is taking place, that's the nucleolus. Right? And so these contain, within the nucleolus, this is where the genes that are actively making ribosomal RNA are made. So all the genes that are contained in somebody's body, we call that the genome. Right? So that just defines all the genes that somebody has. Maybe you heard of the Human Genome Project. And the Human Genome Project was just a long project where they sequenced all the DNA inside of a human cell to figure out where all the genes are. And now we have a pretty good idea how many genes make up the human body or the human genome. All right, but what can you do with a gene? What's the purpose of a gene? What do you do with a gene? What does your body do with a gene? It makes a protein out of it, right? So you could think of the information contained in genes or your DNA as being the genome, but you could think of also all the functions and structures of your body that are made by proteins. We call that the proteome. All the proteins that can be made in your body is the proteome, just like the genome are all the genes that can make up the human body. And of course, there is a relationship between genome and proteome in your body. Does anybody know what the relationship is between genome and proteome right here? I'm just trying to use these terms in everyday language, right? That would be protein synthesis, right? In order to make a protein, you need a gene. How many steps are there in protein synthesis? To go from genome to proteome, how many steps is it? It's two steps. The first step is transcription, and the second step is translation, happen in different parts of the cell, right? Okay. All right, so chromatin is just a DNA strand. So here is a nice long strand of DNA, and you can see it has a nice structure besides the alpha helix. It's coiled up, all right, and it's protected, right, because you don't want to lose that information. The linear sequence of nucleotides right here determines the linear sequence of amino acids in a protein or the primary structure of a protein, and then ultimately its function. All right, so when this DNA is not being used, it's packaged in a very tight form right here, and we call this condensed chromatin. And part of the packaging material are what we call histones. So these little things right here are proteins that the DNA is wound around. These are histone proteins. And when DNA is packaged into this condensed form right here, it's very safe. And it can't get damaged, because if we were ever to break the DNA molecule, let's say we break it right here, then that gene won't ever function. That will damage that gene, and that might actually kill the particular cell. So we don't want to change any of the information or break a chromosome. So it has to be packaged, but when it's packaged, it can't be used for transcription. Kind of a nice way of thinking about that is think that you're going to go on a trip someplace. Let's just say it's spring break, and for spring break, where would you like to go for spring break? How about Bali? That sounds like fun. Okay, let's go to Bali. So when you go to Bali, you're going to take a toothbrush, toothpaste, hair dryer, right? Some swimming trunks or something, towel, what else? Glasses, comb, and you get on a plane with all that stuff like that. All right, with shoes. All right, maybe what else are you going to take? Maybe some goggles for when you're swimming or something, snorkeling. You walk on a plane with your toothbrush and all that stuff just kind of in your hands, just holding on to it. Or what do you do with all your stuff, all your precious stuff? You put it in a suitcase, a luggage. And what does that do? That keeps it from getting damaged, and it keeps it all together so that you don't lose it, right? But when everything's in a luggage, can you use it? No, right? So think of these histone molecules as doing the same kind of thing. It packages up the DNA so it doesn't get lost or damaged, but in order to use that DNA, it has to be unwound from these histones. And that's what we call extended chromatin. So condensed chromatin is safe. All right, condensed chromatin makes this chromosome right here. It's very safe. But you can't use the DNA. If you need to use that DNA for transcription, it has to be extended. All right, and then it can be used for transcription, or that first step in protein synthesis. Okay. All right, so heterochromatin is usually what we call condensed chromatin. Euchromatin is extended chromatin. But I'm going to use condensed versus extended. All right, but in order to see a chromosome underneath a light microscope, it has to be condensed into a chromosome. And usually you'll only see chromosomes during mitosis, not during interphase. So for instance, close your eyes. Let me go all the way back to the picture of that cell. Here's a picture of a cell. Do you see any chromosomes in here? Do you see any of those X-shaped structures? Right? Or in the nucleus right here, do you see any X-shaped structures? No chromosomes. So this DNA is not condensed. It's in an extended form because the cell is using it for transcription. And here's that nucleolus. Right, so you know transcription is taking place right here. All right, so that's a big difference. Now, your cells can control when genes are going to be transcribed. In order for transcription to take place, chromatin has to be extended, and the way that that's done that is via a process we call acetylation or acetylation. So there's an enzyme that is going to acetylate various histones, and the DNA is going to unwind from these spools. And when it unwinds, right, it allows transcription to take place in this area right here, which is the first step in protein synthesis. And if this gene is no longer going to be used for transcription, a histone is deacetylated, and it starts to wind back up, into that nice package form. All right, so what the heck is, you'll see what an acetyl group is in a little bit, but an acetyl group is just a two-carbon fragment. All right, so this little two-carbon fragment is either bound to a histone or taken off of a histone. And if it is bound to a histone, then the chromosome unravels, becomes extended. If that little two-carbon fragment comes off of a histone, then DNA gets wound back up, basically put back in that luggage for protection. Okay, and when it's put back in that luggage, it can't be used for protein synthesis. Okay, so RNA synthesis, what do we call RNA synthesis? Transcription or translation? Transcription, right? Because it has the same language as DNA. One gene codes for one polypeptide chain, right? And each gene is several thousand nucleotide pairs long, right? So it's a very, very long, a gene is a very, very long structure. All right, the enzyme, whenever you see a word with an ASC on the end of it, means that it is an enzyme. It's going to catalyze a kind of reaction. And RNA is made up of repeating subunits. What's the repeating subunit in RNA? It's nucleotides, right? It's the ribonucleotides in particular. So it's a big polymer made up of thousands of nucleotides. And so this, what a polymerase is it's an enzyme that makes a polymer. And in particular, what kind of polymer is it? It's an RNA polymer. So RNA polymerase is the enzyme that makes RNA. It takes ribonucleotides and puts them together. All right, so for transcription, there has to be a start sequence or signal on the DNA molecule. And you know the DNA molecule, is it single-stranded or double-stranded? It's double-stranded. And in order for your cell to see the sequence of bases in DNA, guess what the DNA has to do? It has to come apart, right? So the strands have to separate. We call that unzipping sometimes, right? So DNA polymerase unzips the strand so that the sequence of bases can be revealed to make an RNA molecule, right? There's a promoter region on the DNA, which regulates the levels of transcriptions. And on this region right here, various kinds of factors, maybe even hormones, which we call transcription factors, must bind to a promoter region to start transcription. So transcription is a highly regulated and controlled kind of process. It's controlled by transcription factors that have to bind to promoter regions on the DNA before the RNA polymerase can actually make RNA from the DNA. And we're going to look at some of these controls later on in the class. All right, so here is a nice double-stranded DNA molecule. In order to make RNA, it's got to be unzipped. All right, so what we have are the two strands. So here we see A, C, G. Right, and then A, C, A, G, this is all on the DNA molecule. That's the primary structure of this DNA. Right, and the way RNA is made is that our ribonucleotides then base pair with the DNA nucleotides. And I tell you what, let's go over base pairing for DNA. What's the base pairing rules for DNA? G, C, and A, T. And is that what you see up over here just in DNA? You got GC and AT. Every rung that has a G also has a C. Every rung that has an A has got a T. But RNA doesn't do that, right? Remember that with RNA, uracil base pairs with adenine. So if you look at this molecule right here, even though it's not labeled, you can tell that this is an RNA molecule because it doesn't have any thymines. It has uracil in there, so we know this is an RNA molecule. So here is the DNA template, and here is adenine. On the opposite strand in DNA, what would base pair with adenine if it was a DNA molecule on the other side? Okay, it would be thymine. I'm not sure I see it over there, but it would be thymine. But since RNA polymerase is making RNA, it can't incorporate a thymine. It's going to incorporate a uracil instead, right? And then for cytosine on DNA, RNA polymerase will include a guanine right here because it's the GC base pair, right? So that is how RNA is made. There's got to be a starting area, right? A promoter region on the DNA before RNA polymerase can start to make this RNA. And then when RNA polymerase reaches a stop sign, then this RNA molecule is released and the DNA molecule zips back up together again. Okay, so for what step of protein synthesis is this right here?
Transcription.
Yeah, transcription. And where does that happen? In the nucleus, because that's where DNA is located. All right, so in terms of RNA synthesis, I want you to know three of these kinds of RNAs. All right, not the fourth one. The first one, I'll start at the bottom. rRNA. This is what's used to make ribosomes. Okay, what step of protein synthesis takes place on a ribosome? It's either transcription or translation, so it's got to be translation takes place on a ribosome. All right, so a ribosome is the workbench where proteins are made. What's the building block of a protein again? Amino acid. So a ribosome needs amino acids to put them together to make a protein. And a ribosome can't go looking for amino acids all by itself because a lot of times ribosomes are stuck on endoplasmic reticulum and can't go wandering around anywhere. So it needs a helper. It needs a molecule to bring amino acids to it so that the ribosome can make a protein. And that molecule is the transfer RNA. The job of transfer RNA is to wander around the cell, pick up a specific amino acid and bring it to a ribosome so that the ribosome can use it to make a protein. So another way of thinking of transfer RNA is that it's a taxi RNA, right? It just taxis amino acids around inside the cell. And so we got the taxi, we got the workbench, but we also need information on how to make the protein. That's in this third kind of RNA that we call messenger RNA. And it's the primary sequence of nucleotides in RNA, messenger RNA, that determines the primary sequence of amino acids that make a protein. And if you change this primary sequence of nucleotides in RNA, you change the primary sequence of amino acids in a protein, and then eventually what happens? It changes the shape of that protein, and when you change the shape of the protein, what happens? The function of that protein changes. Okay. All right, so let's take a look at this for a second. Let's see what time is it. Oh, I got a couple more minutes left. Okay. RNA synthesis. Okay, RNA is synthesized, especially messenger RNA, which is very, very long, is made via RNA polymerase, but it's made in a pre-mRNA form. It's much longer than RNA, right? And the pre-messenger RNA contains nonsense regions or non-coding regions. We call these introns. And it also contains segments of RNA which are used to make a protein, and we call these exons. And it took a lot of experiments to figure all this kind of stuff out. But here we see DNA, and of course it has to unzip to make this messenger RNA via transcription inside the nucleus. Notice that some parts of this messenger RNA are colored very lightly and some are dark, right? Are they the same color? Or is one blue and one pink? I have no idea. But can you tell there's two different areas right here? All right. So you see that these lighter regions are interspersed with this darker region right here. And in order for an active RNA molecule to be made, this region has to be cut out. Right. And so this region right here we call an intron. What happens is that the messenger RNA folds, or the pre-messenger RNA folds up. There's a special enzyme that makes a nick here and a nick here, and it glues these two ends together. Right. And the same for this sequence over here. So now you have the actual messenger RNA and a couple segments of basically junk RNA that the cell then breaks down into its building blocks so that it can make more RNA. So the segments that are used for protein synthesis are called exons, the parts that are cut out, are called introns. And what we know now is that when you have a gene that produces this pre-mRNA, there are different ways that the exons can be spliced together. Maybe it's this first one can be spliced with a second one. That's going to make one kind of protein. Maybe the first one can be spliced together with the third segment over here. That's going to make another kind of protein. Or maybe all three exons are going to be spliced together. That's going to make a third protein. So we know now that numerous proteins can be made from one gene. So we would use splicing, right, gene splicing, using these introns and exons to explain why your body needs fewer genes than the protein that it actually makes. Right? Because you could see in the example here, from this one pre-messenger RNA, it can make three or four different kinds of proteins depending on how these exons are spliced together. All right, so the human genome has about 25,000 pairs of genes, yet our body can make over 100,000 different kinds of proteins. We used to think that it was a one-to-one correspondence, but that's not true. All right, so one gene can code for an average of three different kinds of proteins, and we explain that by what? Alternate splicing of exons together outside of the nucleus. So this allows a given gene to produce several different kinds of messenger RNAs depending on what your cell needs. What you see right here is an electron micrograph of one really long molecule, which is a messenger RNA, and attached to it are numerous ribosomes. Right? And what's the job of a ribosome again? To make a protein. And so there's transfer RNA bringing in amino acids to these ribosomes, but the ribosome only knows how to make a kind of protein because this messenger RNA has the information, tells the ribosome what amino acids to put next to each other in the sequence. So in this particular case, this cell is very busy just making this one kind of protein. You can see, I don't know how many different copies, there's what, 15 or 20 different ribosomes right here. They're all making the same protein. So the cell is asking for a lot of this protein. It requires a lot of this protein. So with one messenger RNA, a lot of ribosomes attached to it, we call this a polysome. So when many ribosomes attached to one messenger RNA producing many, many copies of that protein, that's what we call a polysome. So these are the newly synthesized or proteins that are being made. They're not even complete yet. Then down over here, when the protein is complete, the ribosome hops off the messenger RNA, and this protein then can float around inside the cytoplasm. Okay, so how does a ribosome know when to add an amino acid to a growing polypeptide chain? All right, and that's because of base pairing rules and something we call the genetic code. So here is a table that shows the sequence of nucleotides in DNA. So the primary structure in this DNA is going to be TAC, ATC, AAA, all the way down the line on one side of that RNA molecule. But notice that the nucleotides are grouped together in what we call triplets or pairs of three. And the reason is, and I think you kind of probably know the reason, is that how many bases make up DNA? How many letters are in a DNA alphabet? There's only four. And those are, in terms of base pairing, they're GC and AT. There's only those four. But how many letters are there in the protein language? How many different kinds of amino acids are there? There's 20. So if you only have four nucleotides, okay, and they're going to determine the sequence of amino acids in a protein, four nucleotides, if used one at a time, could only call for four different kinds of amino acids. But how many are there? There's 20. So there has to be some combination of nucleotides in DNA that can code for all 20 amino acids. And if there are two, that doesn't quite cover all the amino acids. And if there's three, there's a little bit extra, which is okay. So the triplet code can code for any number of three different amino acids. So this is what we call the triplet code. So let's look at, which one did we look at? Maybe cysteine. Cysteine has that self-hydro group on it. Cysteine will be incorporated into a protein when the DNA triplet code is adenine, cytosine, adenine. That's what's going to be in the DNA. All right? And when this triplet right here is transcribed, what does transcription mean? Going from DNA to RNA. All right, when it's transcribed, what are the base pair rules? What's going to base pair with adenine when it's RNA? Can it be thymine? No, it can't be thymine. It's going to be uracil. So the triplet in RNA is going to be uracil, guanine, uracil. All right, so UGU. And is that what we see right here? Right. So this is what goes into messenger RNA. This is what we call the codon. As a matter of fact, what is this process called of going from ACA to UGU? That's transcription. Where does that take place? In the nucleus, right? All right. And then, okay, on the ribosome, and using transfer RNA with this triplet code right here, the transfer RNA, all right, is going to bring a cysteine in and add it to the growing protein. All right, so when we return next time, we're going to talk about going from RNA to protein. That's what we call translation. Where does translation take place? Give me the name of the organelle.
Cytoplasm.
Yeah, it's in the cytoplasm, but the organelle is called a ribosome, right? That's the workbench for protein synthesis, for translation.